Amendment in Harvest versus Smith and Schifrin, I'm sorry, Harvest versus Schifrin.
If it may please the court, my name is John F. Head, registration number 3077. I represent Margot Harvest. This case involves a dismissal on summary judgment, two claims. One claim for constructive fraud against Leo Schifrin, and another claim against Mark Schifrin, Leo Schifrin's father, for unjust enrichment. The transaction which spawned this case was a sale leaseback option to repurchase, sometimes referred to as a foreclosure rescue, which was popular a number of years ago when homeowners had equity in their property. I don't want to belabor the facts except to point out that there were about five steps that took place here from the beginning to the end on this transaction. A first meeting where Margot Harvest went to Leo Schifrin, who's a mortgage broker, and she wanted to refinance or do something to save her house from foreclosure because it was threatening.
Is mortgage brokering a licensed profession?
It is now.
It is now?
It is now. I don't believe it was then. And then Leo Schifrin said, I can help you. He asked for certain information. She came back the next day or so with information, financial information concerning her financial affairs and the property in connection with the typical sort of application for refinancing. But he explained what the process would be is different than a loan, that he would do a contract to buy the property and then sell it back to her with a lease with an option. And so that sounded reasonable, so she signed these two documents. And then there was a closing about a month later, and what happened at the closing was that that Leo Schifrin had arranged for financing on this house. They basically took all the equity out of the house. The title of the house went to Leo Schifrin's mother, and then Leo Schifrin's mother put a new loan on that house, borrowed all the equity out of it, and then at the end of the closing statement, where there's a check payable to Margot Harvest, which there was, for some $107,000, the closer told Margot Harvest she is supposed to endorse that check over, which she did. She endorsed it in blank. And the check then was deposited after the closing by Mark Schifrin, Leo Schifrin's father. So there went the equity, and the title went to Leo Schifrin's mother. So Leo Schifrin, we sued for constructive fraud. We sued Mark Schifrin for unjust enrichment. And the trial court dismissed both of those claims on summary judgment. And in reaching her decision, she got derailed because, on the logic of it, because she did rely upon the cases concerning the constructive fraud. She relied upon breach of fiduciary duty cases. Well, breach of fiduciary duty and confidential relationship cases are two different things. There's some overlap. And for example, you can have a breach of fiduciary duty that arises from a confidential relationship. There are cases on that. But you don't have to have a confidential relationship for a breach of fiduciary duty. For example, you can have a director of a corporation. That director has fiduciary duties that are owing. There's no confidential relationship there. A trustee will have fiduciary duties to the beneficiary or the beneficiaries. There's no confidential relationship there. There's no quite often there isn't even the beneficiaries don't even know the trustee. So in a constructive fraud case, there is requirement, one of the elements is a confidential relationship. And what a confidential relationship requires is that there is confidence invited, there's confidence reposed, and that the confidence reposed is justifiable. That's what's required for a confidential relationship.
Mr. Head, you said that the information Mr. Schifrin got from your client was typical of any loan application.
Right.
Following your logic to its end would create a confidential relationship between any mortgage applicant and the mortgage broker, would it not?
Yes, it would.
Do you have any case law that says that as a matter of law there is such a relationship?
I haven't found any. On specifically mortgage brokers and the relationship with an applicant for a mortgage.
Same would be true of loan officers at banks?
Same is true as a loan officer bank. You know, and in case, actually, there are cases involving banks with confidential information which they misuse, and they can become liable for that. Although, in the typical general rule of the case, of these cases, is that when a customer goes to a bank to apply for a loan, there's no fiduciary duty that's arises from that. They're just simply a creditor and a debtor. But if that bank uses confidential information or abuses confidential information or somehow uses it to the detriment of the customer, that's the Rubenstein case, that the bank can be liable for breaching a confidential relationship. Now, in the case of a constructive fraud, what the confidential relationship does is that it replaces the requirement of scienter in a common law fraud case. If there's a misrepresentation or there's a failure to disclose, that's an element of a constructive fraud case. But what a confidential relationship does is it replaces the element of scienter. That's the First National Bank of Meeker versus Theos case, which points out that that difference. So what happened here is that the trial court, in relying upon Nicholson versus Ash, which is a breach of fiduciary duty case against a director of a bank by a stockholder of the bank, had nothing to do with constructive fraud. It was not based upon a confidential relationship. And there the court said, and which is a, there's a line of cases in Colorado that says that if you have a breach of fiduciary duty case, what is what you must show is that there's a fiduciary duty that's previously established. You can't have a one-shot deal where there's some interaction between what becomes a plaintiff and defendant, and arises from that a fiduciary relationship, and that very interaction that gives rise to a fiduciary duty cannot be a basis for a breach of fiduciary duty claim. That's not this case. This is a constructive fraud case. And there is no case that says that you have to have a confidential relationship established before and unrelated to the transaction in question. And that was the trial court's mistake in going down that road. Now, so that's what I want to say about at this point about constructive fraud, unless you have some questions. I want to move on to the unjust enrichment case, part of the case. Now, the trial court dismissed the claims against Mark Shiffrin because there's no contract, because there was a contract. The record's clear. There's no contract between Margot Harvest and Mark Shiffrin. In fact, she didn't even know who he was.
Well, let's assume that, that the money had gone just directly back to Leo Shiffrin. Would you have a claim then for unjust enrichment, given the contract that says the money's going to be given this way, it's going to be transferred?
Right. We would.
You would?
Yes. Because, here's why. Because in an unjust enrichment case, the general rule is if you have a contract between the parties which provide for the rights and responsibilities, there's no unjust unjust enrichment case. There cannot be an unjust enrichment claim. Two exceptions to that. One is if the contract does not provide for a remedy, or if the conduct that is complained of is outside of the contract. So given these, varying that one fact, in this case, there would be an unjust enrichment claim against Leo Shiffrin or whoever got the money.
Well, the contract specified, did it not, that the proceeds were to be given to a third party?
That's right, to a third party. If you look at that contract, and there's no, there's nothing in there that Mark Shiffrin is supposed to do. We don't even know who Mark Shiffrin is. We didn't find out who Mark, who got the money, where the money went, until at the outset of this case, I got the check, and you could see that on the back of the check, it was endorsed over to, that Mark Shiffrin's name was put on it, went to his bank account. So what we have here is that contract, that first agreement that was signed, does not provide for anything in terms of what whoever's supposed to get that check, what they're supposed to do, or and what we're claiming here is that the conduct we're complaining about is outside the provisions of this contract. What this is a scheme to take the equity that Ms. Harvest had in her house. And you do that with a sale, leaseback, option repurchase, and you structure the thing so that what it looks like is a real estate contract, a real estate transaction. And at the end of the deal, where you just reset the payments, people run out of, they cannot make the payments, then you evict them. It's real simple. You don't have to.
What about the disclaimers in the contracts that say this is not a loan, this is a sale?
Sure. That was in that document that was signed on November the 18th, after she's signed these earlier contracts, agreements, whatever you want to call them, before, where you can't see what this transaction is by just looking at those documents. You've got to look at what happened in this transaction and where that money went. You cannot figure that out by just looking at the paper.
What you seem to be saying in your argument is that no reasonable person in your client's position would ever enter into this contract.
No reasonable person. They're.
Okay. I mean, it looks like, it begins to smell like, she's been totally taken advantage of.
Right.
But the contracts seem to be clear, and the contracts seem to say exactly what's going to happen.
Your Honor, that's right.
And that's where you think the fraud or the breach of trust, or however you want to denominate it, comes.
Your Honor, you have a drowning man, and you throw him a snake, and they'll grab it on the outside chance it's a rope. And when people are in desperate straits, about to lose their house, they'll sign anything. If they don't understand it, they'll sign it, because it's going to save their house.
But that doesn't make a claim, does it?
Well, if you don't have full disclosure, it does. And you don't have full disclosure in this case. You cannot have unjust enrichment in this case, because there's no full disclosure, and it's not voluntary. This deal of endorsing the check over came after, at the closing. And so there's money payable to Margo Harvest. She's already under contract. She's signed a bunch of documents, including a deed. And the closer says, "Well, by the way, you got to endorse that check over to. You're supposed to endorse the check over. Where'd that come from? You don't find that in the documents."
I signed everything they put in front of me in the closing.
Most people do. And they
frequently
trust.
Frequently without reading it.
I'm sorry.
Frequently without reading it.
It's impossible to read. It's impossible to read those documents in the time that people are given to sign a closing. You got to trust who you're dealing with, and you can be taken advantage of, and scores and scores of people have had that happen to them. This is one case where it cost Ms. Harvest $107,000, all the equity in her house. And in a few short months, she's out in the street. That's what it's designed to do.
Counsel, can I just get a clarification? I think twice you said the first time that Ms. Harvest knew that she'd have to sign the check over was at the closing, but I thought that a generic clause was in the preceding documents that indicated that money would go to a third party. So my question is that accurate that was the first time that, assuming she had read and understood the documents, is that really the first time she was informed about that? And I'm asking, I'm not challenging, I just don't.
You know, I'm not sure that there's a, I don't have the document here, but there's a document, it's in the record, it was signed on October 15th, and that's the companion document with the contract to buy and sell real estate. And I am not sure whether there's language in there that would have tipped her off that that was going to happen. But the idea that this loan that went on this property was not part of the deal, and she had a loan put against the property which was in excess of her buyback price. So, unless there's some other questions, I have scant time left, but I'll save it. Thank you.
May it please the court, good afternoon. My name is Brian Prophet, and I represent the appellees in this matter, Leonid Schifrin and Mark Schifrin. Very briefly, I wanted to go to touch on a couple of facts of this case, some undisputed facts, which are very important, because this idea of a confidential relationship between Leonid Schifrin and the appellant in this matter really is at the heart of this case. It is undisputed that before this transaction, appellant had no prior relationship with Leon and Schiffer. She'd never met him. She had never worked with him. She had never had a loan with him. She'd never heard of him. She came to his office and she asked him, quote, if he could save my home. Now, you heard in Mr. Head's presentation that she asked him to refinance the home. That's not accurate. It is undisputed in her deposition. She stated she doesn't recall asking Mr. Schifrin to refinance her home. In fact, there is evidence in the record that she tried to refinance before coming to Mr. Schifrin. So we're not talking about a mortgage broker type of relationship, which you asked if this was a licensed profession at that time. It was not licensed at that time. It is now. But there were no per se fiduciary duties or anything like that that may have arisen between the parties simply because she came into his office. And certainly not resulting from asking for a refinance, because she did not ask for a refinance. Now, after engaging in due diligence, Mr. Schifrin met with her a second time, at least a second time, and presented her with a written agreement, which you have seen that she signed, that was the sale leaseback repurchase agreement. She reviewed that agreement and she signed that agreement. Now, prior to closing, and I think this answers your question that you asked of Mr. Head, there was a second agreement. This was prior to closing. I do not remember the exact date, if it was the same day as closing or before. I do know that it was after the original agreement, but it was prior to closing. And in that second agreement, she provided that any funds that she received from closing would be endorsed to a third party designated by the buyer.
Why? This is what bothers me about this whole transaction. It seems like a flimflam from the beginning, okay? Now, there may have been some colorable benefit to Ms. Harvest, but the house goes to the mother, the money goes to the father. It just, I'm sorry to say, it doesn't pass the smell test.
Well,
can you explain to me why a sentient person and Ms. Harvest's position would enter into this agreement knowingly and intelligently?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It provided what she had asked of Mr. Schifrin. She asked him to save her home. She was concerned about bankruptcy. She was concerned about foreclosure. She was concerned she was going to lose her home. I hesitate.
What she did and which you could say would be highly predictable in light of the structure of the deal.
You know, that's right, Your Honor. But she received the benefit of her bargain. She was allowed to stay in that home for a period of at least 2 years. I can't remember exactly the period of time. She made payments. The lease payments that she made, it's undisputed, were less than the mortgage payments she had been making before. Basically, the whole point of this agreement was for her to have an opportunity to put her finances back in order. And she was able to do that, or at least she should have been able to do that, because her monthly payments were less than her prior mortgage payments. So she was able to save money, or at least was given the opportunity to save money, so that at the end of this two-year period, she could seek to repurchase this house
Let me understand correctly. In exchange for paying over $107,000 in equity, if in fact there was any equity, but paying over $107,000 for the privilege of paying a few hundred dollars less a month for 24 months.
No, actually, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Your Honor, no. She was given the opportunity to repurchase the house for $225,000, and if, in fact, there was equity in the house, which Mr. Head states, and I would argue that's not an undisputed fact, but really it doesn't go to the heart of whether there was a confidential relationship here. But nonetheless, she would basically receive that equity back at the time she sought to repurchase. She never sought to repurchase.
How did she get the equity back?
Pardon?
How would she get the equity back?
The $225,000, which she was given the opportunity to repurchase the house for, was below market value. And so by purchasing it for $225,000, and I don't know what the value of the house was after that two-year period of time, but it states in the agreement that the $225,000 is below market value, that's how she would get that equity back, Your Honor. She would have it back in the home. Now, I want to go back. As I mentioned, she was able to live in the home. She received the benefit of her bargain. She didn't lose the home to foreclosure or bankruptcy as she was concerned. There's evidence in the record that she also had a daughter of, I believe she was in high school, and she had stated that she wanted to remain in the home at least until her daughter graduated from high school, she received a benefit from this bargain. But she now claims she was defrauded by Leo Schifrin due to this confidential relationship that Mr. Head urges you to adopt. Now, the trial court was correct in determining there that the constructive fraud claim should be dismissed because of a lack of a confidential relationship between the parties. Now, Mr. Head states that the trial court judge was confused by the idea of a breach of fiduciary duty claim versus a constructive fraud claim, and I would argue that's not accurate at all. A confidential relationship is spelled out very eloquently in the case law here in Colorado. A confidential relationship can arise in a number of ways. Whether it becomes the basis for a future fiduciary duty between the parties, or whether it is an element of the constructive fraud claim. But this court in Nicholson v. Ashe clearly said, the prior Colorado opinion suggests, and we hold, that the confidential relationship giving rise to the duty must have been established prior to the date of the transaction that gives rise to the claim. Now, whether or not you are using this as a definition of confidential relationship for a breach of fiduciary duty claim, or the definition of a confidential relationship for a constructive fraud claim, the case law is very clear. The relationship must have arisen prior to this transaction. The undisputed facts show it did not. There was no confidential relationship here because this was the only transaction between these parties. Now, Mr. Head would have you overturn Colorado law and find that a confidential relationship can arise out of a single transaction between a lender and a debtor. And he admits to you that he would suggest that a confidential relationship would arise in any lender-debtor relationship where the debtor provides the lender with financial documents. Now, I would argue that as a matter of public policy, this court simply can't allow that to happen. To indicate to a bank, to a lender, that a confidential relationship may arise simply because you have asked for and accepted financial documents from a party would have a chilling effect on commerce in this state. And so as a matter of public policy, Mr. Head's suggestion that a confidential relationship can arise from a single transaction by providing financial documents, this court simply can't allow that to happen. Now, even if this court were to overturn Colorado law in Nicholson v. Ashe and say, yes, there was a confidential relationship here, the trial court still found in its order that even if there was a confidential relationship, that there is no evidence that there was a breach of any duty that was created by such confidential relationship. The judge looked at the written agreements between the parties, determined that those written agreements clearly stated every aspect of these this transaction, and determined that there was no breach of the duty as a matter of law. So this court can dispose of this appeal simply by finding there's no confidential relationship. But even if you find that there could be a confidential relationship, there's another basis that the trial court made its determination to dismiss the constructive fraud claim in finding that there was simply no breach of the duty by Leonid Schifrin as a result of the detailed first and second agreement, which was voluntarily signed by the appellant. Now, finally, I want to touch just very briefly on the unjust enrichment argument here. Mr. Head argues that the confidential relationship that he claims arose between Leonid Schifrin and the appellant also attaches to Mark Schifrin, who was the individual who ended up, he was the third party as set forth in the agreement. He refers to a case in his reply, the Lewis case. But I would argue that case doesn't apply for several reasons. One, and this is a matter of black letter law, there is a contract specifically referring to the subject matter that he wants the court to make a quasi-contract for.
Not a contract between she and Mark, however.
No, but the case of, and I apologize, it'll take me just a moment to come up with the name, the case law in the state of Colorado doesn't say that the contract has to be between the parties to the unjust enrichment claim. Rather, and it's Interbank, I think is the name, Interbank Investments versus Eagle River Water and Sanitation District says that it's the subject matter of the express contract which governs whether or not it will preclude an implied in law claim. And clearly, the second agreement, which is a part of the record in which you had the opportunity to review, says exactly what's going to happen with any money that comes out of the closing, that it will be that she entered an agreement to sign it over to a third party. Now, there's another argument that even if you decided that the unjust enrichment claim could somehow stand because Mark Schifrin was not a party to that agreement, and that's the voluntary payment rule, which has been adopted by Colorado. Ms. Harvest, the appellant, she didn't have to sign that check over. She received a check for $107,000 with her name on it, and she could have taken it and run. But she followed through with the agreement that she had signed, the contract that she had signed, and she voluntarily endorsed that check over. Such a voluntary payment with in this state precludes her now from bringing an unjust enrichment claim for the return of those monies. And so, in conclusion, I would urge this panel to affirm the decision of the trial court in finding summary judgment against the appellant on her claims of constructive fraud as well as unjust enrichment. And if there's nothing further, I thank you very much.
Well, very briefly, Your Honor, I have to be brief because I have 51 seconds. The debtor-lender relationship does not. We're not asking the court to change anything about the law. We're just asking the court to apply it. Because in the Rubenstein case, there was a bank customer, who had given the bank confidential information. The bank abused it by giving it to third parties. And that's where the bank got into trouble. And that's and so that is an example of where you have a relationship between a bank that's a debtor-creditor, but when the bank steps out of it and disseminates information, confidential information, to third parties, the bank can be liable for it.
Is there anything in the record that would indicate this financial information was used to the disadvantage of Ms. Harvest?
Yes. What happened was that he could see from her financial information that she could not refinance her house, and she had a loan on it of around $200,000 is the balance on it. The deal was that she could buy it back for $225,000. If she can't refinance a $200,000 loan, how is she going to refinance a repurchase at $225,000, which would be $225,000 plus all your fees associated with the repurchase? You know, day one, anybody who is dealing with a customer on day one knows that that customer cannot buy that house back. And so what should have been done at the time this transaction is going, and of course somebody who's taken advantage of somebody is never going to do that, but you should disclose to your customer that they're when they sign all these papers, they're losing their house. They're losing their equity. And what she has to do is to sell her house at some price that somebody will pay, and to realize her equity that way, because the transaction that was crafted here by Leo Schifrin, where his mom got the title, his dad got the money, no way that Margo Harvest could ever realize 10 cents out of her equity. And I'm out of time, so if there's no more questions, I thank you very much.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course.